Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
But I always don't think about the money part of it. I think about the labor part of it. And I think about the fact that we have this tradition here in Indiana and we let it go.
John Kay is talking about making oak rod baskets. These were part of everyday life in Brown County, Indiana at the turn of the 20th century. They were made by farmers, and now the practice has all but disappeared. Today, we'll hear the story of these oak rod baskets. What Idaho's now overturned ag gag law means for similar laws around the country. Grain prices are low and farmers are worried. A couple stories from Harvest Public Media. Then a special recipe to celebrate Rosh Hashanah. We make challah and share stories with the folks from Muddy Fork Bakery. Food news, Mark Chilla's here.
Taxing soda is a key strategy for health advocates to reduce consumption of sugary drinks and tackle obesity. The idea is that retailers would pass the extra cost to consumers, who would drink less because of the increased price. The tactic worked like a charm in Mexico, where a national 10% soda tax in 2013 decreased sales by as much as 12%. But what if stores don't increase soda prices? Two economists compared soda prices in Berkeley, which imposed a 1 cent per ounce tax this spring, to prices in San Francisco, where a similar beverage tax failed to pass. The results, published in the National Bureau of Economic Research, showed that prices rose by less than half of the tax amount in Berkeley. Only 22% of the tax was passed on to consumers for Coke and Pepsi. So why isn't the tax working as well as it did in places like Mexico? For one thing, the Berkeley tax only affects a small area that's surrounded by stores where the tax is not in effect. David Frisfald, one of the economists who authored the report, said that means stores may not be increasing their prices because they're worried it would decrease their sales. The effect could have been very different if California had imposed a statewide tax, he said, though that kind of speculation is outside of the wheelhouse of this study. Reaction to results of the tax has been mixed, with health advocates focusing on the $116,000 in revenue raised during a one-month period, and the beverage industry pointing to the new study as a big "we told you so" aimed at policymakers. Results from a new study this week. Researchers found that 12 to 14% of Americans had diabetes in 2011 and 2012. That's up from about 10% since the early 90s. But the rate has remained level since 2008. An additional 38% of adults have pre-diabetes, which means half of all American adults either have the disease or its precursors. The fourth largest chicken company in the U.S., Perdue, is poised to purchase Natural Food Holdings, which owns the Nyman Ranch brand. Nyman serves a specialty meat market focused on antibiotic and chemical-free products and supplies pork to the Chipotle restaurant chain. Perdue's acquisition signals another step in the company's quest for organic, pasture-fed, and pharmaceutical-free products as conventional meat sales shrink in the U.S. and demand for specialized meats grows. Nyman Ranch's founder, Bill Nyman, recently told Business Insider that he cut ties with the company 10 years ago because it, quote, fell into the hands of conventional meat and marketing guys as opposed to ranching guys, unquote. And news from McDonald's this week. The fast food behemoth will change how it buys eggs. The North American branch of the company is giving itself 10 years to source its eggs from chickens raised in a cage-free environment. McDonald's joins Nestle and General Mills in the cage-free movement. But as NPR's Dan Charles suggests, cage-free is not what many farmers prefer. Instead, enriched colony cages give chickens room to move around and spread their wings, and they include nests for egg laying. Consumers, however, prefer that cage-free label. There's even more to know about these stories, and you can find the articles at eartheats.org.
Also, Twitter, y'all, at eartheats. Our newsman is Mark Chilla.
See you next week.
Earlier this summer, a judge in Idaho overturned a law that made it illegal to take undercover video on farms and ranches, saying it was an unconstitutional attack on free speech. It was the first federal challenge to a so-called ag gag law. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, the Idaho case could have ramifications across the Midwest.
When news of the Idaho judge's decision came to Matthew Dominguez, a lobbyist with the Humane Society of the United States, he says he felt vindicated.
It has been a shot in the arm.
Dominguez travels across the country attempting to convince lawmakers not to pass an ag-gag bill. He says in the last decade, they've proliferated in states like Missouri, Iowa, and Utah.
We've seen ag-gag bills be introduced in states across the country from your most red states to your most blue states.
Ag-gag is the colloquial umbrella term for a few different types of laws. They're crafted to curb undercover investigations by making certain acts illegal, like lying to an employer to gain access to a farm, or secretly recording an operation without the owner's permission. Dominguez says with the Idaho law struck down, the others across the country could be in jeopardy.
The groups that were involved with challenging this in Idaho are going to look to the courts to nullify and to strike down the existing ag-gag laws.
That means a whole new slew of lawsuits could pop up. Utah's law is already being litigated. But the groups that push for this kind of legislation maintain that the legality of undercover recording isn't so clear-cut. Bob Narabout is with the Idaho Dairymen's Association, which helped draft that state's law.
Legislation was designed and crafted to try and protect First Amendment rights while also trying to provide some personal property protection.
Imagine driving down a country road, Narabout says. You park the car on the public street right next to a large farm.
I have every right to sit here and film and document what's going on. When I'm on private property, just like if I was at your house, then there's some restrictions.
We all take for granted that the right to record for radio or TV is some speech-type activity, but the Supreme Court has never had the occasion to say that.
That's Justin Marceau, a law professor at the University of Denver and the lead attorney for the animal rights groups who challenged the Idaho law. He says ag-gag brings up thorny constitutional issues, some that could eventually find their way in front of the Supreme Court, like whether lying or video recording is protected speech. Meanwhile, he says, ag-gag laws sit on the books of six other states.
The investigations have shifted to states that don't have these laws, and that's kind of the purpose, right? I mean, if you pass a law in Idaho, you hope that the investigations will happen in Colorado and hurt their businesses instead of Idaho.
The video you are about to see was shot by a Mercy for Animals investigator at Cactus Acres, a Dairy Farmers of America cooperative farm in Colorado.
This is audio from a viral undercover video released earlier this year.
Workers viciously kick and punch cows, stab them with screwdrivers, and violently beat animals with poles and other objects.
After this video was released on the website gotmisery.com and racked up thousands of views, the owners underwent audits and were put on suspension by the cheese company they supply milk to, though they weren't charged with a crime. If it had been recorded in, say, Iowa, the activist who shot it could face jail time.
Every single year, I think it's going to get worse.
Matthew Dominguez from the Humane Society says now with legal precedent on his side, it'll be easier to convince lawmakers not to pass ag-gag laws.
And after the ruling in Idaho, namely striking down the laws unconstitutional, I'm actually hopeful that the industry has learned their lesson.
But ag-gag laws are evolving. Some states put time limits on reporting animal abuse, and others impose civil penalties on some whistleblowing activities. In the last few years, more than 30 ag-gag bills have popped up in state legislatures across the country. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up in the second half today, how falling grain prices could impact rural economies. John Kay came into the Earth Eat studios this week with a basket. It was a wooden basket, medium-sized, woven. He told me to grab it and squeeze it to feel how strong it was. It didn't even make that creaking noise you associate with wood baskets. It was just firm.
This is a basket that my great-great-grandmother used to both feed the chickens and to gather eggs in.
So how many eggs, how many dozens of eggs could we put in there? 4 dozen eggs, do you think?
Well, I think probably more. You're looking at 5 or 6 easily.
He's the director of Traditional Arts Indiana. His latest project looks at the history of these oak rod baskets in Brown County, Indiana. When his grandmother gave him this basket, she also gave him a picture of his great-great-grandmother using it. The photo probably dates from around 1919. He can't tell if she's feeding the chickens or collecting the eggs, but it's clearly a tool for her farm work in Heltonville, Indiana.
They work out real well. They feel good on the hand, better than that little plastic spindly piece on a 5-gallon bucket when you go. So,
putting in the crook of your elbow, I would imagine, too, that, yeah. So free up both of your hands to do some things, and I'm
exactly.
imagining.
And the nature of the way it's made, you think about what happens when you set down your 5-gallon bucket. The handle flops over. This, if you're constantly moving through the field, you're just kind of moving this along with you, and the handle's always in the same place.
This is an oak rod basket. She didn't make it herself, but someone did. Kay says all baskets, even today, are made by hand. She probably bought it from someone she knew, maybe a farmer neighbor who made these in his spare time. You can imagine just how much force and effort it must have taken to weave the strands of wood into the basket.
This one is an oval-shaped basket. Looks kind of like a willow basket, but it's made with these long white oak rods, which the makers would have pulled through these dies to kind of render the splits of white oak into a round form. And it made for a very strong, sturdy basket. And then it's got a single handle over the top that they would have wrapped, or they did wrap, with white oak all the way around it to make it kind of smooth and stronger. The ones that were intended for heavier use, they would have twisted as well as wrapped around them to make them extra strong and sturdy.
And we're talking turn of the century when people are making and using these?
Yeah, this would have been well, the tradition was brought to Brown County in about 1848 and continued robustly until probably after World War II. There were men, almost exclusively men, that made these baskets in this region, and they were listed in census records as basket makers. So where all their neighbors were farmers, and they were probably farmers, day laborers as well, they considered themselves basket makers.
Kay tracks oak rod baskets back to three families, the Hovises, the Bohalls, and the Morgans. Henry Hovis was the man who brought the tradition to Brown County in 1848. George Bohall taught his five sons how to make baskets. That family was so famous, oak rod baskets were often called Bohall baskets. A bit later on, Rube Morgan and his family got into basketry. These were sold to hardware stores, to their neighbors.
And how do we find out about how these baskets were used? We can see them in museums. We can see them in thrift shops and those sort of things. But we don't understand that much about it. So what I've done is I've kind of combed through historic photographs and found images of the Ping family gathering hickory nuts near their home. You can see the shagbark hickory trees all around them. And you see two of these oak rod baskets on the forest floor there as they're sitting around gathering up the hickory nuts. You can see images of near Stonehead of a big long table with the family all standing behind it, the food all spread out on the table. And underneath the table, nicely tucked away, are a few of these oak rod baskets. They would have carried these baskets full of food to important family gatherings when they went. So these would have been just an ever-present, constant part of everyday life for a lot of folks in this region.
That was in the 20s and 30s. Then big city tourists started visiting Brown County and wanting these baskets as souvenirs. Demand went up. But then after World War II...
there were a lot fewer of these type of baskets and more fancy baskets that were being brought up from Kentucky and Tennessee were being made primarily by women that with fancy plated handles and decorative rims for them instead of the work baskets that the locals used and made.
And in terms of using the baskets for farm work, they just didn't make sense anymore by the 50s and 60s. There were plastic buckets and cardboard boxes and canvas bags. Nowadays, we've sort of come full circle. It's charming to carry a basket to the farmer's market. Knitters and crafters will use baskets like these for their materials.
There are people all over this region now that are collecting these oak rod baskets. They've become very kind of highly desirable. Now in an antique mall, I can still find them for $15 or $20, you know. But if someone knows what they are, they're selling for $100 or $300 for a big laundry basket or something like that. But I always don't think about the money part of it. I think about the labor part of it, and I think about, you know, the fact that we have this tradition here in Indiana and we let it go. But we're not alone. There was about 6 or 7 states that had small pockets where oak rod baskets were made. And as far as I can tell, I've asked around, I think it's pretty much gone everywhere.
It's hard to know when the craft really stopped. The way Kay describes it is it just sort of faded away. One of the last basket makers he tracked down was Bruce Hovis, Henry's grandson. He made baskets through the 80s, and so did a grandson of George Bohol. But that was the generation that didn't pass on the skill to their kids. Kay speculates it was because the lure of better money doing less strenuous work in the city was more enticing. All this research Kay has been doing will be on display at Indiana University's Mathers Museum through next February. Through his work, he managed to track down another descendant of the Brown County basket makers.
I actually went to talk with Claude Morgan, Rube Morgan's son, who actually made one basket when he was a kid. He's probably the last of the makers, you might say, even though he says he's not a basket maker. He made one.
Kay asked to see the place where Rube Morgan did his work back in the turn of the century.
Because, oh, our family doesn't own that property anymore.
Kay insisted because he knew Morgan used to write his patterns on the wall where he worked.
And he goes, what? I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, let's go see if we can find it. And we went to the barn. Now, this guy died in 1981. He went to the barn where he used to work, asked the people who own the property now. I go in there, and on his wall, on the door jamb, and on posts of the walls of his barn, he has all the materials written out, what lengths, how many rods, what length of the rods they needed to be, what you start with pattern for each one of his baskets. You know, if you needed to make a laundry basket, if you needed to make a hamper, if you needed to make a baby basket, if you needed to make all these different forms that he had, the recipes, you might say, right there on the wall of the barn.
Jackpot. He snapped pictures so he could analyze Morgan's process and write up his recipes. The current owners say Kay got there just in time. They had been thinking about putting a fresh coat of paint on that wall. John Kay is a professor of practice at Indiana University. See a picture of him with his great-great-grandmother's oak rod basket at eartheats.org. Coming up, some bread baking with Muddy Fork Bakery for Rosh Hashanah. We hear how easy it is to make challah and what this tradition means to one young family. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome. You eat challah on the Sabbath and on Jewish holidays, like Rosh Hashanah, which begins this Sunday evening. Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery is doing a special bake this weekend, fresh challah, just hours out of the brick oven. He made challah for his family last year for Rosh Hashanah and decided to do a big bake this year for his customers. I stopped by the bakery midweek to watch him prepare his test batch.
Especially for a holiday, you want it to a holiday. You want it to be fresh. So challah is an enriched egg bread. Enriched means that it has some fat added to it. So it has flour and a little bit of sugar, yeast and salt, and eggs and olive oil for the fat. not everybody uses oil in the challahs. There's many bakeries that will use butter because of the flavor being nice to have a buttery flavor. But it's not actually traditional to use butter in the challah because Jews who keep kosher will want to keep dairy and meat separate. So using butter is a dairy, makes the bread dairy, and then you're only supposed to eat it with dairy if you follow those rules.
On process of forming challah at Muddy Fork, just ahead. Farmers in the Midwest are facing a situation they haven't seen for a while. Grain prices are down. And after some of the most lucrative years they've seen ever, some producers could lose money on this year's crop. Grant Gerlach reports on how farmers are managing the downturn and how it could affect the rest of the rural economy.
Corn's moving along pretty fast, Lauren.
I'm out checking the crops with Keith Dietrich and Lauren Broberg, farmers and neighbors in northeastern Nebraska. We're walking down a narrow road through one of Dietrich's cornfields. It's a wall of tall green stalks on either side. We stop to pull back the husks from an ear of corn bursting with golden grain.
This looks like excellent corn. I'd say 200 plus easy, wouldn't you, Keith?
Yeah.
On yield?
Probably. So.
That's 200 bushels per acre, a strong stand thanks to almost perfect weather in this part of the state.
We've had the best amount of rainfall we've ever had in a growing season as far as timeliness and to have our production where it needs to be.
This is a big crop.
It's a big crop.
But what will that look like in terms of profits?
Marginal profits at best, most likely losses. The best crop we ever raised.
The best crop these farmers have ever raised, and most likely they'll lose money. And it's even worse in parts of Illinois and Missouri, where the weather didn't cooperate. Corn prices peaked in 2012, then came some of the biggest corn crops in history. With that oversupply, prices got cut in half. Still good by historical standards, except Broberg says things like seed, fertilizer, pesticides, and even land cost a lot more.
Well, our input costs tended to really accelerate in the last 2 or 3 years when we had higher commodity prices. It seems like we have a hard time to get those input costs to come down.
Combine those higher costs with lower prices, and the result is sobering. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, this corn crop is worth about $7 billion less than last year. The agency is predicting the largest single-year drop in farm income since 1983. How are farmers getting by? One way is by the bank.
Going in through 2014, we did see loan demand picking up at that time, but it's continued to rise.
Nate Kaufman is an economist at the Omaha branch of the Kansas City Federal Reserve. Fed surveys show farmers are taking out more loans and larger loans. New and young farmers tend to be the deepest in debt.
And so it does kind of raise some of the level of concern among lenders as they're looking at a sector that has been performing very well, but being cautious about what that means going forward.
At the same time, he says farmers are spending less, especially on big-ticket items like combines and tractors. So machinery makers like John Deere and Case New Holland are taking the biggest hit in the farm economy today. They've cut hundreds of jobs at factories in states like Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska. But Vernon Schmidt of the Farm Equipment Manufacturers Association says sales are not falling across the board.
Anything that involves livestock, members that I talk to tell me that they're doing extremely well. You know, their supply of back orders is good at this point.
Crop farmers might be feeling the pain, but livestock producers, especially cattle ranchers, are doing well. And that's one sign that just because the market for row crops is down doesn't mean it's time to panic. There's still a lot working in farmers' favor. Oil prices and interest rates are both still unusually low. Land values are down, but not plummeting. And even though China's economy has slowed down, it's still a huge customer for U.S. corn. Nate Kaufman at the Federal Reserve says any potential crisis is still a ways off.
Coming off of the level of income that we saw 2010 to 2013, it would take more than just 1 or even 2 years to think that we're at a point where that sector is starting to face some long-term problems.
Corn prices could turn on a dime if a weather disaster hit farmers in South America. But for now, farmers will take to their fields to haul in the harvest, even if they lose money on every bushel. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Muddy Fork is located about 15 minutes outside of Bloomington, Indiana. When you pull up to their spot, you see a hoop house and a lush garden. The house is up on the hill, surrounded by trees. The bakery is down by the garden. Katie Zukoff is part owner of Muddy Fork Bakery with her husband, Eric Shedler. As he forms the challah, she tells us how she views the tradition of eating this sweet bread on the Sabbath and on holidays, now that their two little girls are celebrating it with them.
I went to a Jewish day school, and we had challah at school every Friday. And we had an early dismissal on Friday. And so it was a time when the whole school got together, and it was just a time to relax and enjoy maybe just about 20 minutes, but enjoy being with our friends and teachers. We all took turns bringing in the challah and the grape juice for that.
I've got about 4 pounds of dough here for our test batch. Special challah dough with raisins in it. That's the tradition for Rosh Hashanah, is to make a challah with raisins, or usually it would just be dough without raisins. And each one of our rounds is going to be made up of two strands that we'll twist together and then roll them into a circle or a spiral, sort of like if you imagine taking a woven strand and making a rug out of it. That's how we'll do it.
I have taken a long time that I was not eating challah regularly and observing the Sabbath, but recently my daughter started going to preschool at Gan Shalom here in Bloomington.
I also make my own slice at school.
They make their own challah at school every week.
Okay. There we go. Got our favorite bench scraper for cutting the dough. Get a little flour for the table.
Yeah, each child makes a very small loaf.
Yes.
Spread out the dough into sort of a rectangle so I can get pieces that have a little bit of a bigger surface area. I'm going to roll some strands out of this.
And my other daughter is 18 months, and she also loves challah, and she even says, "Challah, please," when we get to school, and she wants some of her sisters.
I'm sharing.
Challah, please.
Pull out a pan, and so here I'm twisting the dough into two strands together into a little rope, and then I'm going to roll it up into a circle.
Just like a bun on the back of a woman's head.
Exactly, yeah. In the morning I'll take them out and brush them with egg wash, and if they seem like they've risen enough, I'll put them in the oven, and if they seem like they haven't risen enough, I'll let them rise a little more before I bake them.
I can see that it's something that they really look forward to, having this time. Like, they sit on my lap and we sing songs also, and then we eat the challah, and it's a sweet bread and it's light. And I think all kids like bread, but challah is maybe just a little bit sweeter than your average sandwich bread. So it's something that they really look forward to, and we all enjoy spending that time together.
Challah, please.
Lita and Ruthie, along with their parents, Eric Shedler and Katie Zukoff. Thanks to them also for sharing their recipe for the challah. Find it at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Great day. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Annie Corrigan.